Today we are going to take up, in some detail, the theory of flows, the single flow theory, and the theory of counterelasticity. And the first one we will talk about will be counterelasticity. This, you understand, may or may not be true of flows in general. There may be such a thing as a pure flow, which is actually a single one-way flow. There may be such a thing. That would be, however, this strange thing called a flow with no friction. And that we know is an impossibility. Because a flow with no friction would simply flow forever. Therefore, the small turbulences present in any flow, no matter what it is doing, are sufficient to put a break point on that flow. They are sufficient to stop the flow. This seems to be particularly true of very high frequencies, such as human thought. Again, we are postulating, we are a little bit beyond our level of knowing when we talk about this. I'm trying to describe the upper range, just above what we know. When I say the frequency, the friction, the interbulence, the countermotion. Now I'm going to talk about exactly what we know. We know that a flow of energy requires two different potentials. A flow will flow between two different potentials. One potential a little bit higher than the other potential. We know this is very, very easy to find in a preclear. You simply rig up an aesthetic flow, watch what happens to it. An aesthetic picture, watch what happens to that aesthetic picture. You'll find that there's a flow to it. And you rig up a horrible picture, and look what happens to it. There's a flow around it. And when you get a little bit higher in the handling of this energy, you will discover that a flow line can be determined by you simply by setting up potential A and potential B. And you get a flow from A to B. And in de-aberrating people, you particularly are interested in the fact that they do not self-determine the direction of flow, nor the potentials of flow, nor the position or the time of incidence. All of aberration could be said to fall under this category at this time. And that is that a person does not know the time and space of each and every facsimile and ridge which he has. And his sanity and his ability and his horsepower depends utterly upon his ability to do this. And if you were to draw a scale of relative self-determinism, it would be the scale of ability to put in time and place each and every facsimile and ridge. So that if one were able to put 0.001% of his facsimiles and ridges accurately in time and place, he would be a sane man. But if he can put only very arbitrary figures, 100,000 billionth of his facsimiles in place, he's in bad shape. This tells you immediately, this law tells you, this is a law, actually. It's an axiom, I suppose. You have in that the answer to psychosis and its cure. Psychosis is the loss of ability to determine time and place. Future time and place, for instance, present time and place, for instance, position, past time and place for facsimiles and ridges. Your psychotic has lost his ability to do this. And he is psychotic in the degree that he's lost his ability to do this. So how do you cure psychosis? You just persuade him to put things in time and space. The first start on any psychotic is told to you by this observation. You simply let him locate where he is. And if you can't find him where he is, and if he can't locate himself where he is, let him locate himself somewhere in the past where he was. Insanity is past. Neurosis would be concern about the present. Sanity would be actions in favor of the future. This is a definition, an old definition in the subject. But the psychotic is always evidently in the past. He's all mixed up in facsimiles, and he's all piled up in them. So you either get present or past locations of time and space. You can take a psychotic, and if you can make him locate a light switch and know it's a light switch, you have advanced deeply into the morass of insanity. If you make him locate a door and know where the door goes, if you let him locate the fact that you have a ring on your finger, if you can get him to locate you, to say, you're sitting there in front of me. Yes, of course. He's already on his way to sanity. I don't know people. I can't remember people. He says, you say, can you remember me? And he sort of comes out of his fog. Yeah, you walked in the door a few minutes ago. Quite often, a person low on the tone scale, when you ask them, let's see if you can remember somebody who's absolutely real to him. They'll think for a moment, they'll look at you, and you'll see a smile break out all over his face. You. Yeah, you're real. Huh? Triumph. Almost a line charge. You just go from there on and on and on. Locations in time and space, locations of memory. Can you read the first process, which is a good process to use on straight wire on a psychotic, is can you remember something that is absolutely real to you? The reality of something is the ability to place it in time and space. That's reality. Reality is an agreement. And so where did everybody agree that thing was, and did I agree with them, and I knew it was there too? That's it. A time when he was fully in communication with someone, a communication moment that was absolutely real to him, and a moment when he had an emotion which was real to him. These moments can be sneaked up on, and if you can get him to spot his present time moments, he can spot his present time emotion, that is his affinity, his present time state of affinity, his emotion, whatever it is, his present time agreement or disagreement with his surroundings, and his present time communication with his surroundings. You brought him up to present time. If you just walk into a sanitarium sometimes and you say to a patient, you just meet the patients one after the other and you just tell them, you smile at them and say, come on up to present time. Do you know that a certain percentage, a low percentage, it's true, but a certain percentage of those people will turn sane that instant? I mean, really sane. This happened in a place up in Michigan. A fellow auditor walked down the hall. This was the most spectacular one that's been reported because it had everybody in a spin up in the whole sanitarium. The staff spun in Brightley Lane. Auditor went down the hall. He told somebody this. I'd mentioned this several times. This thought he'd tried out. So these psychiatrists were being very sort of dull about the whole thing. So he said, well, I can go down the hall. I can cure somebody just by walking down the hall. Well, yes. Well, you know, we've been walking up and down the hall here for the last 100 years, and we've never cured anybody. But you say you can. Well, show us. So he just walked down the hall. And, by the way, the whole jibe here is toward American psychiatrists. I know British psychiatrists are much more reasonable. Now, walking up and down the hall, he simply stopped 3 or 4 people, and he told the girl, come on up to present time. She looked at him. Looked around, sort of.
course she was glad to be there.
And that night, this girl hadn't had a word to say for about 3 years. Nobody could get her to talk or anything else for about 3 years. And she had a terrible case of acne on the face. That night, all the patients, everybody had a party, and she got up and she made a speech about how glad she was to be there. And 3 days later, the acne on her face was gone. She behaved very sanely thereafter, remained stable, and was discharged from the sanitarium. Total therapy time. Come up to present time. Now, you see that could be quite effective. That could be quite effective. You don't expect very many people to respond to just those phrases. If you've ever had a preclear on the couch, you run them back down the track, you tell them come up to present time, there's always a lag. If they're really coming up to present time, they just open up their eyes, you know, they're stuck on the track. But they little lag. You know, they always kind of expect a little bit to have you say hello or something. Like they've been away and they're back again, and they want to be greeted. So I used to greet the preacher every time I told him come up to present time. I little lag, and he'd open his eyes, and I would say, well, how are you? He'd be very pleased. He never saw anything strange about this at all. It was as though he'd suddenly gotten off the train or just arrived for dinner or something. And it cheered him up, and it had the effect of making him want to stay in present time. Because present time was pleasant. He was accepted in present time. All right. This should tell you, then, that any technique which orients with this definition, you see, of self-determinism. What is self-determinism? Self-determinism is the ability to place in space and time. What is self-determinism? It's the ability to place in space and time. That tells you right away, as a definition, the answer to how to bring people up to present time. If they don't respond, you just say, come up to present time. They don't respond to it. They don't come up to present time, and they still seem a little bit foggy and unreal. You get them to place present time carefully in time and space. And they'll think this is awfully silly sometimes. Somebody who is quite sane. This, by the way, is not just a technique for the insane. Somebody who is quite sane, you can pull this on, with considerable effect. You say, where are you? And the fellow says, Durban. No, I'm not in Durban, am I? It's London. Okay. London, what's the address? So-and-so? So-and-so. Randolph Avenue. Oh? Now, what body are you in? Oh. I'm in a body called Jones. You'll say everything's getting a little bit brighter to me. And you say, now, what room is this? Of course he knows where he is. He can tell you he knows where he is. And sometimes he'll tell you with considerable annoyance, well, I know where I am. I'm in Durban. I mean, London. So, he says, he just goes through it. I'm on the second floor. It's the front room. Time is about mid-afternoon. Yes. And you ask him, well, now what clothes have you got on? Don't bother running him back in the past, because that's only relationship. He'll immediately think, you see, of clothes I've got on. Well, yes, I just got on clothes. And he'll try to bring himself up to present time on each article of clothing, if you'll let him. Let's see, I put on these shoes this morning. They were under the bed. I had to look and find one. And the coat was in a... Oh, no, the cat slept on the coat last night. Yeah. Was I mad this morning? And he found out he was stuck on the track about his coat. Mad at the cat for sleeping. He'll say, yes, and... I spilled some egg on my tie at breakfast. Yeah. He'll maunder along like this for some time. You just let him maunder. He'll all of a sudden get around to the point of, got a tie on! Well, what do you know? I got a tie on. It'll actually come to a very sane person sometimes with that much of a shock. This is a neck, and it has a collar, and there's a tie. Just like that. The tie, and the touch of the tie is so-and-so. And we get off to the second stage of it. You've got him oriented now. Let's orient him perceptively. The color of the wall. optical sight. Color of the wall, the color of the picture, this and that. Optical sight. The touch of this, the feel of his shirt, the feel of his undershirt, the feel of his shorts, the feel of his socks, the feel of his shoes, the feel of his belt. You're getting all oriented mess-wise. He's perfectly willing to orient mess-wise. What do you know? The next thing you do, if you really want him in present time, is orient him theta-wise. Let's get the feel of the wall. I can't feel the wall from here. No, feel the wall. You know I can't do that. Well, go ahead, this time. Oh, it feels like plaster. I did feel the wall. You know, that's very strange. But I did feel the wall. Yeah, I wonder if I could do that again. Doubtful that time and so forth. But I can feel that picture. I can feel that picture. I can feel that girl's lipstick. Hey, what do you know? New horizons open. You can get a theta perceptic orientation by making him see to depth, then. See to various depths, feel to various depths, and what do you know? Hear to various depths. You're all of a sudden liable to find him completely bogged. As you do this, you run him into present time, and then theta-wise, he's stuck somewhere on the time track. Well, at least orient him and find out where he's stuck theta-wise. You see how you can do that? So you could bring him up with all the mess body perceptics, and that seems fairly real to him, and now bring his theta perceptics up to present time. You want a therapy? Well, truth be told, you could sit in an office and become famous beyond fame for the magic of your healing by just knowing that axiom or whatever it is and definition of self-determinism and ways and means of establishing the person's whereabouts for him. That's all you'd have to do. Just get the variations on it. And the darndest things would happen. The second you start to play with Miss Q on the subject of this, she's had a terrible backache, and every time she starts to orient herself as sitting in your chair, she gets a twinge in her back. And instead of insisting she come to present time or anything like that, you just wander off onto some other perceptic in the present time. And then all of a sudden there's another twinge in her back and another twinge in her back. And all of a sudden, this is not, wouldn't happen all the time. But occasionally, you get almost a horrible explosion in her back. Bang! And disorient her again. And then reorient her again. And she hasn't got a backache anymore that she's had all those years. Orientation in present time. Now, how could you carry this out further? One of your therapies is orientation in the past. That works very well on psychotics and neurotics. Extremely well. And works very well on people who are quite sane. Because in the past, you will discover incidents of considerable aberrative magnitude by just straight wire, which is to say orientation of the incident in the past with relationship to the future, you have established a considerable release of the incident. Your PC, however, is even further burdened, and he is being subjected to forces by incidents which occurred in the past which he cannot identify. And the reason why the force is bad, and the reason why it upsets him, and the reason why it hurts him is because he can't orient it or identify it. Well, just identification of it on an e-meter occasionally will sort of make it diminish. Just identification by an e-meter. An e-meter process is even more than an auditor's process. Therefore, although my old pal Walney will tell you, never let the preclear look at the e-meter, he always comes over and whenever he watches me processing and finds the e-meter facing the preclear, always gets uncomfortable about it and then says, oh, Ron can get away with anything. Yeah, obvious. The truth of the matter is only at that moment when the preclear starts asking the e-meter for confirmation. He'll say it was 100 years ago, it was 500 years ago, it was 600 years ago. Waiting for that bop. And when that e-meter bops, he'll say, okay. He's fed the e-meter in as a circuit. And he takes its memory instead of his. And he'll start doing this on everything that happens. That's bad, but you notice when it happens with a preclear. The preclear all of a sudden says, well, I know very well I was... I came to Earth here a long time back. The e-meter does a bob. That's a confirmation. You pass him on the back. It says, that's right, old boy. He'll proceed with a little more confidence. Well, I came to Earth here quite a while back. All of a sudden, he can recall it. But unless you, as an auditor, step in there and make him recall it, not just recall what the e-meter said, but recall what the e-meter said. You got the double-stage process. The e-meter flicks, runs, and so forth, and he varies the figures. Then you get him to recall it straight. The incident's there. He can recall it. No trick for that. But secondarily, make him recall the incident. That is to say, orient it in time and space. It occurred on Alpha Centauri 8,283 years ago. The e-meter says so. His recall says so. All of a sudden, his recall gets a little bit better. You come up the line markedly. Now, you start running out facsimiles and chewing into facsimiles only when they won't budge. You can't get them oriented in time and space. Run them out. At such a time. Use black and white, aesthetic processing, and a few other things and run them out. Spot them, knock them flat. That's actually when you run a facsimile. That answers a question. You could ask the question, when should you audit a facsimile? When, the answer is, when the preclear cannot locate the incident in time and space and feel that he has located it with affinity, reality, and communication. He has ARC on this incident. It seems real to him. It was there. It did happen at that time. In other words, you get it with a good level of knowingness. When he doesn't respond with a good level of knowingness on an incident, there is an incident that's blocking back there. You can do this incident then two ways. You can locate minor things leading back to that incident and just sort of dig it out. By the time you get to the incident, sometimes, oddly enough, he can just sort of take the whole incident and just move it over. And say, well, saves a lot of auditing. When do you audit it? When you can't orient it easily in time and space and cannot orient the locks which are sitting on it in time and space. When you cannot orient it by finding the ridge it's sitting on in time and space. And when the incident definitely and certainly influences the modern current present time behavior of the preclear. When do you audit an incident? When it is observably aberrated, when it cannot be easily located in time and space with ARC. How do you locate it? Well, try to spot things leading up to it. Spot them. Straight wire, get them in space and time, and get it up with good ARC, and maybe the incident itself will never have to be run. And if after all that, the incident's still there, you can't find it, you know what it is, and so on, run it. And how long do you run an incident? You run an incident until it no longer is out of the control of the preclear. You run an incident until the preclear can ably locate it in time and space. That's how long you run an incident. And if you follow those rules on the auditing of incidents, you will discover that you will save yourself an enormous amount of auditing time. And you will discover something else. That your preclear's state of beingness will consistently change. Whereas, if you just plunge in and audit incidents, you find them on the e-meter, you audit the incident. You don't orient it particularly, you just plunge the preclear into it. You let him run a theta trap forever, and you never find out when that theta trap occurred, how it occurred, who did it to him, why. Well, you could audit that theta trap for 15 hours, for 20 hours. Actually, what I'm telling you right now is the secret of fast auditing. Orientation in time and space of incidents. Where did your father stand. The person says, oh, yes, my father punished me all the time and so forth. And, well, let's recall one. Just one. Yeah, I've got one. Where were you standing? Now, if you carry this out to a complete reduction, you can move him right straight into the incident. Not particularly desirable. You want to him to remember enough about this incident until it's quite real to him. And boy, you sure know. You don't need any emir to tell you when that incident has become completely real to him. He's in good shape, and you've spotted it down the line. The moment he finds it, the incident, ARC, he's got a spot in time and place, he tells you. He tells you. If the incident was aberrated and should have been located in time and space, was the incident aberrated? I mean, defined in the ARC on the incident suddenly good? He tells you. Only he doesn't say, you know, the ARC is now up on this incident. I have it oriented in space and time. He doesn't know anything about that. You know about that. He tells you. He says, ha-ha. He said, huh? Oh. Yeah. You just hear that little chuckle. Sometimes when you hit it right on the button, he'll say, ha, ha, ha. And go on ha, ha, ha-ing until the neighbors and other people around will awfully well wish he'd quit. Because he starts locating that one incident in space and time, and he starts locating another incident in space and time, and another, and another, and another one, and another one, and another one, and you're stretching his time track out faster than you can speed a person like that than just words. You can say, well, let's not laugh about that anymore. Think about taxicabs instead. Something serious like taxicabs. Well, totally disrelated to the subject. He'll say, taxicabs? Every taxicab that he's ever seen is suddenly oriented in time and space. They're going by so fast he can't even see them. And he gets a pretty charge out of it. And he suddenly starts to bog on that, and he isn't laughing about taxicabs anymore. And you say, newspaper stories about children being run over.
Silly.
You say, all the mean things you've done, all the mean things you did to your mother. Actually, you can spot them on anything you want to feed him. If you get him going on spotting things, it's sort of build. More things will build up on the whole thing. Okay. That's orientation in time and space. Now, what does this have to do with flows? The theory of a single flow. All flows contain in them some friction. The fellow who insists on speaking with reservations, he doesn't come up to you and say, you know, I just cured somebody, and they're going to stay cured. I know they are, and I know I figured this all out, and boy, do they feel good, and did I do a good job of auditing. How many people you'll find do that? Not very many. Boy, he'd one to be that explosive about it. He wouldn't be as well as he could be, but he'd be way up above normal on that. What is reservation? Reservation is introducing into an outgoing flow an impetus to make it flow less hard and hit less hard. So your fellow comes up to you and he says, well, he said, I just had it pretty clear. And of course he said that he felt better. As a matter of fact, he did show some signs of looking better, but one always has to take into account that these things usually don't. And I don't know, I probably could have done a much better job of auditing. A lot of it afterwards probably could have. And he thinks he's done a wonderful job, but that's the way he lets you in on it. That's a heck of a note. That's what's known as reservation. Now, you could see reservation in conversation can have a picture drawn. Here's your PC, and here's your outgoing flow. Now, here would be your flow going out from the PC, perfectly straight. And he actually will monitor it by putting an interference into the flow. He's checking it all the way. He's holding it from going out. He does this conceptually. That the outgoing flow is very conceptual on the thing. And he checks it by being reserved and conservative about what he's seeing. And if this is the accepted way to talk, and if one is expected to modulate in this fashion, why, that is conforming. But nevertheless, it's restraining a flow. Single flow. Now, let's come down to what are flows and what aren't flows. Action is one thing. Action consists of energy outputs and inputs. Action is energy interchanges on a gross messed level. Energy changes on a gross messed level. That's action. All right. Action and thinking are two different things, a little bit. Thinking consists of energy interchanges on a much milder, smaller wave level. The strange part of a being is, that when he is no longer capable of action, he thinks. But thinking is a shadow of action. And action, which is beneficial and forward and optimum solution action, stems from thinking. So you get an interaction between them. But remember that the last end of any person's existence is thinking. The last end is thinking. That's why you get introspection, extrospection, so forth, as being regarded rather aberrative. And also why some person who does thinking is regarded actually with a little bit of distrust. They think he must be in pretty bad shape. By the way, they think he must be out of action. Well, the funny part of it is this can be a gradient scale. It's like anything else, it can be a gradient scale. Here's the action level he's capable of. Here's the thinking level he's capable of. That'd be pretty well balanced, isn't it? He could think, he could put into action what he's thought about. Or he goes into action when he's thought about it. And understand that thinking can be quite swift. That'd mean he'd go into action with fairly good judgment. He would go into action with doing things. All right.
That'd be the action-thinking ratio.
Believe me, if a person does an awful lot of thinking, if he would be fairly well balanced and even, you would see whether or not he went into a lot of action, too. You can't judge one of these points by itself, you understand, because there's an interrelationship. So a person does a lot of thinking and no action. What you're observing then is a defeat and a backup from action. He has failed enough times in action so that now he just thinks about it. And when you get an awful lot of action and no thinking about it at all, you know that that's equally bad. You know that that's occasioned by other determinism. Other determinism. He doesn't think much about it, but he goes into an awful lot of action. He obeys his impulses of action. Here's your teenager. He's driving down the road, and all of a sudden he throws the car up to 60 miles an hour. Residential area in a school district. He wants to drive the car fast. He wants to do it at that moment when he wants to do it, and he drives the car fast. Swoosh. This child is operating solely because of other determinism. He has a desire for action, and his ability to think about action and exercise his own judgment has been squashed and repressed, so he's out of balance, very badly out of balance. There's nothing wrong with a 16-year-old or a 60-year-old person going into action of 60 miles an hour. If he wants to go into action at 60 miles an hour, I can assure you it's much more fun to go out on a race course and turn it loose at 120 miles an hour. There you can really get some good speed. And if you want to really have a good time, you can pile up a lot of broken bottles and so forth in little heaps and mounds at irregular places and drive through them at 100 miles an hour. That's fun because, you see, if you want the element of danger, come in on it, the risk, make it spicy and all that sort of thing, fix it up so that if you drive wrong, you'll get a blown-out tire and that'll wreck you. And you can do things like this. It sounds idiotic, but you put up your own impedances. Or, more rationally, you could just set up a series of flags and things like that and learn to drive amongst and between these flags. And that is quite a lot of skill required in something like that. You'll find out that that could be a hobby all by itself. He wants to go 120 miles an hour. If he's driving an automobile, however, and his yearning is to go 480 miles an hour, he's in the wrong vehicle. An automobile just won't go that fast, that's all. What he wants is a jet plane. And if he hasn't got a jet plane, well, there must be something wrong with him if he can't work himself up into a position where he's a jet plane jockey. So action and thought, you see, could interlock but when they go out of balance 60 miles an hour through a school zone with a lot of little kids in there. That's just stupid. But it's action. And conversely, a fellow who sits down introspectively and extrospectively and just thinks and thinks and thinks and thinks. If he doesn't have an impulse to go into action with that thinking, he's awfully bad off. So what you want to examine when you're diagnosing, word used very advisedly, assessing a pre-clear, is to find out whether or not he is on parity level between action and thought. Fellow says, I'm worried about myself. All I do is think. You know, you have a therapy you can get in. You can say, well, why don't you go out and act? He's liable to say, just like come up to present time. You know, I never thought of that. Huh. Yeah, I think I will. Here's a guinea. Goodbye. Perfectly happy. Brand new thought. Go into action. Only he'll start. There's another therapy. He's all I do is sit and think, and I just introspect and brood, and I just never get any place, and so forth and so on. And you say, well, why don't you put somebody into action? Oh, I couldn't do that. Well, who's stopping you? Oh, the thought that somebody might be stopping him in present time suddenly occurs to him. And he said, why, there isn't anybody much stopping me. Say, what do you know? There isn't anybody in present time stopping me. You know, my mother and father used to stop everything I did, though. They wouldn't let me do a thing. Love you, son of a gun. There isn't anybody stopping me in present time. I think I'll so-and-so. He goes into action. It could be that idiotically, stupidly simple to solve his problem. What you're doing in this case is trying to establish a parity between action and thinking. And remember that there is a capacitance from being to being for action and energy. I mean, action and thinking. There's a capacity. A person has one and then the other. If a person has a capacity for being able to think a thought and then move a teapot, and that would be about the parity level on the thing. He's either terribly down tone scale or he just doesn't have any power. One or the other. He might be all the way up tone scale and might be perfectly happy and cheerful to think that thought and then move the teapot. Strikes you as strange. But here's somebody else who thinks the thought. He thinks, here's Tesla. He says, let me see, you do so-and-so, and you work out the circuit this way, and you work it out that way, you work it out this way, and work it out that way, and you work it out the other way. Then he goes out to Colorado, and he establishes a ground wave, and he puts 100 horsepower motor to going, and he builds some standing waves, and he lights a light bulb a few hundred yards away with no wires connected to it. And he says, well, that's perfectly good, all right. I'll figure it this way, I'll figure it that way. And he goes over to Long Island and starts to build the first transatlantic, what you would have called today, radio communication tower. Death caught him before he finished it. But here wasn't any guy just sat and thought. It was a fellow, he would think a thought through and then he'd go into action. Then he'd think another thought through and he'd go into action. He was a formidable man, really. Frightening fellow to be around. Absolutely frightening. Or at least so did everybody else working in the field of electricity think. But knew him. Very frightening. He kept going into action. And Lord knows what he'd think of next. He'd go into action with it. That's horrible. Well, that's perfectly all right if you're goofy enough just to sit around and dream up a circuit. Don't build a circuit. Don't ever mock it up and build it and so forth. Just think about it. That's now. We got you under control. You'll find the person who is busy trying to write, the artist, the rehabilitation of the artist, comes right into this field. You're going to be asked to rehabilitate the artist. There are many ways to rehabilitate the artist. You can rehabilitate his aesthetics simply by picking up the maybes on his aesthetics. That's all. The maybes on beauty and ugliness. That's about all there is to it. You rehabilitate the artist, you can put him back in action again. But what is his action? His action is not of a magnitude with his thinking. He sits there and he writes a play, and the play consists of terrible human emotions that go pounding around all over the place, and empires being blown up and falling apart and so forth. And what is his level of action? Pushing a pen across a piece of paper. No. He'll go mad eventually. Just like that. It's not comparable. And you'll get the thought eventually that when I think of empires going this way and that way and so forth, I know that the greatest amount of action that will occur will be a pencil going across a piece of paper or somebody picking up a copy of the magazine and turning the pages. Lots of action there, isn't there? Furious action. The most furious action there is on any place, and it does a... Oh, boy, does this do a writer a lot of good. Take him down to the printing plant. When a story's going through, you'll find out it'll make a considerable difference in his viewpoint. Here sits a machine, big machine, and they're going, whir, crash, 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 and there's magazines coming out all over the place, and there's paper coming out, and people are charging around all over the place. On what subject? His story. He'd be enormously braced up. Look at all the action icons. I did all that thinking, and there's some action. Ha! He feels pretty good about the whole thing. Before, he looked at it very quietly. In any case, your writer, printing presses or no, is going to run down. You should, if you want to rehabilitate an artist. You say, what'd you used to write about? Oh, I used to write about... You used to write a lot of flying stories. How long has it been since you've done any flying? Ooh, not for 20 years. Why don't you go out and fly? You know, that's an idea. That's an idea. It'll work automatically. If you can persuade this writer who is interested in writing flying stories to go out and fly, he'll write a story about flying. Because your theory of flow, thinking to action, action to thinking, is a difference of tone scale. It's the band between effort and emotion and aesthetics and reason, a double band. Aesthetics, reason, effort, our emotion, effort. Aesthetics, reason, emotion, effort. And you can get a four-way interchange there. They go into action. Rehabilitation of an artist is simply rehabilitating it. And the way to really process an artist is by the physical universe. Make him go out and get some incoming motion, some incoming action, which will engage him in action. And now he can have an interchange of flows between... Now, he's gone ahead and he's gone toward effort and emotion. Effort and emotion. From aesthetics and reason. Toward effort and emotion. Toward effort and emotion. Toward effort and emotion. Single flow. Single flow. And, of course, eventually all the potentials on it are uncharged. He just overbuilt it. And on the theory of single flow, this business of conservatism, stopping it from going out, sort of apologizing for doing it, will eventually lock the whole flow up, and he won't be able to flow in that direction anymore. Now, the way to shake the thing loose in present time is simply to get effort and emotion slugging back on the same track, and it will actually shake loose the reason and aesthetics. It'll shake him loose. But you can't make every artist go out and drive racing cars or bum a trip down to Africa and get lions to bite him. You can't do this. Although you will find that the successful artist, the world around, whether it is in the field of music, whether painting, or anything else, is the fellow who is continually out on the other side engaging in action. The writers, the painters, the musicians who have lasted a long time have lived fantastically active lives. It's very well to think of the artist up there in his ivory tower, never moving. Take Ernest Hemingway. He puts out more consistent material, whether you consider it bad or good. It's very consistent. He has an enormous public. And that man never spends a year without going into action. When he was mixed up in writing For Whom the Bell Tolls, he was knee-deep in the Spanish Revolution. And he wasn't just sitting around twiddling his thumbs in the Spanish Revolution. He was throwing back hand grenades. He knew the boys that were fighting the revolution, and he was taking a hand in it himself. He was having quite a time for himself. He almost never got out of Spain alive a dozen times. Now you could unbalance this. This artist can go ahead and work in the field of action, 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 until action becomes the goal. And there again, you have got another potential. What you're doing is exchanging between effort and emotion without ever getting into reason. So you could go action, action, action. And that's what happens to your workman, your longshoreman. What happens to your doctor and so forth. Their action is just action. Action, action. One kind. They just go on and work. And the work is its own reward. So you've got a closed circuit there. And they just go on working. And they go on working and they work some more. And your law of single flow will catch up with them. Your workman eventually works himself out. He eventually gets tired. He eventually gets to a point where he cannot, at the crack of the whip, pick up those 200 pounds and run like a racehorse up the gangplank with them. He can't do this anymore. Single flow has caught up with him. He is engaging in one set of potentials without another set of potentials to the degree that his set of potentials become inactive. Now, I don't mean to stress that overly, but I don't think I could stress it too much. I really don't think I could overstress it to him. Because it tells you immediately what you do in order to bring a person up into a level of activity again. It isn't enough to simply say we're trying to bring people into action. It isn't enough to say we're trying to bring people into some thinking, some thoughtfulness about existence. Neither one of those things would give you a therapy. We are not trying to discharge energy out of people either. Very limited viewpoints. You see that an optimum solution would be an interchange between reason, aesthetics, effort, and emotion. And you've got to get that interchange going. So you look at your doctor, and your doctor, you can be the dirty trick to pull on a doctor. Say, well, doctor, what you need is a vacation. You need a rest. Now, this is practically the only medicine he knows, which says change environment, change environment, change environment. He knows it, and he knows it works. It has a percentage of workability which is very high. Percentage of workability of maybe 20, 30% of the people he gives this advice to, when they take the advice, improve. Well, now let's get it down to refining law so it won't work just 20% and so that the improvement will be very large. Here's your doctor. He's been cutting people up and cutting people up and cutting people up and cutting people up, and he's been applying knowledge and applying it and applying it in skills and applying it in skills. One-way traffic. Strictly one-way traffic. He's been applying it. Now, you don't have to vary the potential very much to get a flow. You just say to him, doctor, let's say he's been working on Park Avenue. You say to him, doctor, why don't you go over 9th Street and work over there in the free clinic for children if they have one. This doctor's been working with him. This is Gottbucks. And all of a sudden, he's working with these little kids. And the highest pay he gets is one day, a little kid that he's helped to walk by some operation or something comes in, and she's got a flower that she's picked out of somebody's flower pot, and she gives him this flower. And all of a sudden, he sees that that doesn't compare with some other things, and you've got some action, some interchange. You can throw him over there. If you throw him over into the clinic on that cheap, poor neighborhood, very solidly in terms of action, you'd better be careful because he may have treated Mrs. Gottbucks so long and so arduously that all of a sudden, on just the suggestion of such an advice, he becomes obsessed with 9th Avenue. And there he is over on 9th Avenue. And even if he has to live in misery and squalor or something like that, all he's going to do is charity work. Well, now all you say about Mrs. Gottbucks may be true. But she still deserves some doctrine. And only by treating Mrs. Gottbucks once in a while can he go on and eat himself while he treats all these kids. But he needs at least two levels of activity, which are reciprocal. Now, Mrs. Gottbucks, for prescribing for histamine, all he has to do is scribble something on it. Say, yes, yes, yes. And scribble it on a prescription blank. And the secretary sends a bill. That's all he's been doing. He receives from Mrs. Gottbucks an enormous, and from that whole practice, was practically an inflow. He'll really be treating people who don't much need treatment. You get which way that line is flowing? The line he will feel is flowing from the patient to him.
The auditor in the States,
who has tied himself down to Mr. Rich, gets to be an apologetic and sorry case. I don't care what state his case is in, because his present time's no good. And if you, in auditing, neglect the single flow aspect of present time, you'll fail with preclearance. Because you may patch them all up in wonderful condition and then set them back into an environment which they'll be able to charge along on just because you patch them up. But they're going to go the same route. They'll go exactly the same route that they went before. Now, you see, all that is necessary for you to do on a one-way flow, messed from Mrs. Scott Bucks to the doctor. You've got that one-way flow. Will you just process that as a one-way flow? Spot and assess your case on the lines of what is the one-way flow of the current lifetime. If you want to do just an office patch-up on this individual, assess him on the grounds of what is the one-way flow of the present lifetime. You'll find some girl married whose husband does nothing but talk to her. Talks to her all the time. He never gives her a chance to say a word. And she goes down, 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 down. She is receiving an incoming flow, and the incoming flow is a one-way flow. You see, a one-way flow can be incoming or outgoing. She's got a one-way flow, and a one-way flow, and a one-way flow, and a one-way flow, and a one-way flow. It's very funny. It's very funny what she will do if she is suddenly given somebody she can talk at. You'd think, well, she won't talk at this. It'd be your job to find out what she could talk at. And by the way, you can find that on an e-meter. You could say, what do you feel you could talk to her? Men? Or you could kind of sag. She says, no, I can't talk to her. Well, can you talk to other women? No. Can you talk to tradespeople, servants? Well, how about cats? Can you talk to cats? New thought. I could talk to cats. I sure could. Yes, sir. It'll show up on the e-mirror. It'll tell you very definitely that talking to cats is not at all disturbing to her, but on the contrary, gives the upsurge of, gee, that'd be nice. Think of having a cat. Call up her husband, tell him bring home a kitten. You think that's silly, but by golly, it'll cure more people. One-way flow. You know the secret behind this thing. And so you can spot it.
This works out again. This iconic
has flowed in one direction until he's stuck. And he'll actually stick himself on the time track by flowing in one direction too long and too consistently without anything ever flowing back at him. He gets in horrible shape if he does this. And he'll become, if he carry it to the ultimate, he'll become pretty psycho. Now, let's take the psycho who tries to help and fails. He can't get a flow. He wants to help his wife. Let's take a case with which we may have a little conversance, which is the same as many, many cases. He wants to help his wife. He wants to help some women in his vicinity. He wants to help them. He can't. He can't flow in that direction. They won't let him. He tries and fails. He tries and fails. They're showing him all the time. Very proudly, you're not flowing in my direction. All of a sudden, the guy gets more and more frantic, more and more frantic, more and more frantic, and he practically spins in. Well, now you can process it. Sure. You can process it. You can put in a lot of hours and pick up all the times that he tried to help women and couldn't. And then you will find why he's trying to help women. If you want to go at it on a long session of processing, why he tried to help women, and you'll find out that that was an overt act of some sort that he performed. You can audit that out, and it will relieve this anxiety about helping women. And quite often, when a guy has gone that bad, the only thing to do is locate that overt act. Whatever he is trying to help, he's hurt. You can put that down as a law. Whatever he's trying to help, he has hurt. And that, of course, is modified by the fact, by the word anxiously. Whatever he is trying to help anxiously, he is hurt. You better write it down that way, because it might make you feel, or it might make somebody feel hearing that, that anybody who is trying to help something or is trying to do something or get something done is obviously very guilty. And actually, your psychoanalyst sort of underneath it believes this. So that he believes in no motion, you see, if he believes that. He believes nobody should help anybody if he believes that any help is the result of an aberration. It's not. Because get the rest of this law. Whatever he's trying to help anxiously, he is hurt. And to cure that, you pick up the action and chain of his hurting it. And the times it has hurt him. You get the overt act and the motivator, the deads and the dead exes, off of that channel. Just work it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Flows. And you want to process flows on this. You don't want to process words. You don't want to process a lot of odds and ends. You want to process flows. Get the help flow of trying to help women. And get it right. The fellow says, I can't get it right. All right, get the help flow of trying to... of not being able to help women. And, of course, that's a sort of a turbulated backflow. And he can get that white. That's help and not help. He can get that white. You process that until it's white. Now, get trying to hurt women. Can't. Trying not to hurt women. Ah, that's the power of the side of the flow you can get. That flows for a little while. Then you try to get trying to hurt women. And you get that flow. That flow is white. Now, trying not to hurt women. Now, women trying to hurt you. Now, women trying not to hurt you. Now, you trying to hurt women. Now, you trying not to hurt women. Now, women trying to hurt you. Women trying not to hurt you. The darnest messes of garbage will come up off of this case. But it's just on the level of white flows. White flows. Get them white. What's he trying to help? Well, you can get it then by trying to help it, being unable to help it. It's trying to help him, being unable to help him, and hurt. Is trying to hurt this thing that he's trying to help. And this thing that he is trying to help, hurting him. And you get those by dichotomy, positive, negative, each one. Hurting him, him hurting it. Him helping it. It's helping him. You get the idea. So that little axiom, whatever you call it there, that is a process. And that little process, whatever he is trying to anxiously help, he is hurt. Process the help, process the hurt. And the anxiously will come up just as a matter of course. You'll find that he'll hang for quite a little while, and everything will turn white after he's run this for a little while, on just to get the idea of anxiousness. And now get the idea of anxiousness about, let's say, birds. He's been trying to help birds and so forth. And get the anxiousness about birds. Now get birds' anxiousness about you. You can process the emotion. But it will turn up automatically. You really don't have to process that. Okay, before we go on with single flows, let's take a break.